Chapter 15. Flesh before Almayer's eyes, a gold ring set with a large green stone. "You know this well," he said. "It never left Dane's hand. I had to tear the flesh now to get it off. Do you believe now?" Almayer raised his hands to his head and let them fall listlessly by his side in the utter abandonment of despair. Babalatchi, looking at him curiously, was astonished to see him smile. A strange fancy had taken possession of Almayer's brain, distracted by this new misfortune. It seemed to him that for many years he had been falling into a deep precipice. Day after day, month after month, year after year, he had been falling, falling, falling. It was a smooth, round, black thing, and the black walls had been rushing upwards with wearisome rapidity. A great rush, the noise of which he fancied he could hear yet. And now, with an awful shock, he had reached the bottom, and behold, he was alive and whole, and Dane was dead with all his bones broken. It struck him as funny. A dead Malay. He had seen many dead Malays without any emotion, and now he felt inclined to weep, but it was over the fate of a white man he knew, a man that fell over a deep precipice, and did not die. He seemed somehow to himself to be standing on one side, a little way off, looking at a certain Almayer who was in great trouble. "Poor, poor fellow! Why doesn't he cut his throat?" He wished to encourage him. He was very anxious to see him lying dead over that other corpse. "Why does he not die, and end this suffering?" He groaned aloud unconsciously, and started with affright at the sound of his own voice. Was he going mad? Terrified by the thought, he turned away, and ran towards his house repeating to himself, "I am not going mad. Of course not. No, no, no." He tried to keep a firm hold of the idea. "Not mad, not mad." He stumbled as he ran blindly up the steps, repeating fast and ever faster those words wherein seemed to lie his salvation. He saw Nina standing there, and wished to say something to her, but could not remember what, in his extreme anxiety not to forget that he was not going mad, which he still kept repeating mentally as he ran round the table, till he stumbled against one of the armchairs and dropped into it exhausted. He sat staring wildly at Nina, still assuring himself mentally of his own sanity and wondering why the girl shrank from him in open-eyed alarm. What was the matter with her? This was foolish. He struck the table violently with his clenched fist and shouted hoarsely, "Give me some gin! Run!" Then, while Nina ran off, he remained in the chair, very still and quiet, astonished at the noise he had made. Nina returned with a tumbler half filled with gin, and found her father staring absently before him. Almayer felt very tired now, as if he had come from a long journey. He felt as if he had walked miles and miles that morning and now wanted to rest very much. He took the tumbler with a shaking hand, and as he drank his teeth chattered against the glass which he drained, and sat down heavily on the table. He turned his eyes slowly towards Nina standing beside him, and said steadily, "Now all is over, Nina. He is dead, and I may as well burn all my boats." He felt very proud of being able to speak so calmly. Decidedly he was not going mad. This certitude was very comforting, and he went on talking about the finding of the body, listening to his own voice complacently. Nina stood quietly, her hand resting lightly on her father's shoulder, her face unmoved, but every line of her features, the attitude of her whole body expressing the most keen and anxious attention. "And so Dane is dead," she said coldly, when her father ceased speaking. Almayer's elaborately calm demeanor gave way in a moment to an outburst of violent indignation. "You stand there, as if you were only half alive, and talk to me," he exclaimed angrily, "as if it was a matter of no importance. Yes, he is dead. Do you understand? Dead. What do you care? You never cared. You saw me struggle, and work, and strive, unmoved, and my suffering you could never see. No, never. You have no heart, and you have no mind, or you would have understood that it was for you, for your happiness I was working. I wanted to be rich. I wanted to get away from here. I wanted to see white men bowing low before the power of your beauty and your wealth. Old as I am, I wish to seek a strange land, a civilization to which I am a stranger, so as to find a new life in the contemplation of your high fortunes, of your triumphs, of your happiness. For that I bore patiently the burden of work, of disappointment, of humiliation amongst these savages here, and I had it all nearly in my grasp. He looked at his daughter's attentive face, and jumped to his feet, upsetting the chair. Do you hear? I had it all there, so, within reach of my hand. He paused, trying to keep down his rising anger, and failed. Have you no feeling? He went on. Ave, you lived without hope? Nina's silence exasperated him. His voice rose, although he tried to master his feelings. Are you content to live in this misery, and die in this wretched hole? Say something, Nina. Have you no sympathy? Have you no word of comfort for me? I that loved you so. He waited for a while for an answer, and receiving none shook his fist in his daughter's face. I believe you are an idiot, he yelled. He looked round for the chair, picked it up and sat down stiffly. His anger was dead within him, and he felt ashamed of his outburst, yet relieved to think that now he had laid clear before his daughter the inner meaning of his life. He thought so in perfect good faith, deceived by the emotional estimate of his motives, unable to see the crookedness of his ways, the unreality of his aims, the futility of his regrets. And now his heart was filled only with a great tenderness and love for his daughter. He wanted to see her miserable, and to share with her his despair, but he wanted it only as all weak natures long for a companionship in misfortune with beings innocent of its cause. If she suffered herself, she would understand and pity him, but now she would not, or could not, find one word of comfort or love for him in his dire extremity. The sense of his absolute loneliness came home to his heart with a force that made him shudder. He swayed and fell forward with his face on the table, his arms stretched straight out, extended and rigid. Nina made a quick movement towards her father, and stood looking at the gray head, on the broad shoulders shaken convulsively by the violence of feelings, that found relief at last in sobs and tears. Nina sighed deeply, and moved away from the table. Her features lost the appearance of stony indifference, that had exasperated her father into his outburst of anger and sorrow. The expression of her face, now unseen by her father, underwent a rapid change. As he had listened to Almayer's appeal for sympathy, for one word of comfort, apparently indifferent, yet with her breast torn, by conflicting impulses raised unexpectedly by events as he had not foreseen, or at least, did not expect to happen so soon. With her heart deeply moved by the sight of Almayer's misery, knowing it in her power, to end it with a word, longing to bring peace to that troubled heart, she heard with terror the voice of her overpowering love commanding her to be silent. And she submitted after a short and fierce struggle of her old self against the new principle of her life. She wrapped herself up in absolute silence, the only safeguard against some fatal admission. She could not trust herself to make a sign, to murmur a word for fear of saying too much, and the very violence of the feelings that stirred the innermost recesses of her soul seemed to turn her person into a stone. The dilated nostrils and the flashing eyes were the only signs of the storm raging within, and those signs of his daughter's emotion Almayer did not see, for his sight was dimmed by self-pity, by anger, and by despair. Had Almayer looked at his daughter as she leant over the front rail of the veranda, he could have seen the expression of indifference give way to a look of pain, and that again pass away, leaving the glorious beauty of her face marred by deep-drawn lines of watchful anxiety. The long grass in the neglected courtyard stood very straight before her eyes in the noonday heat. From the river bank there were voices, and a shuffle of bare feet approaching the house. Babalichai could be heard giving directions to Almayer's men, and Mrs. Almayer's subdued wailing became audible as the small procession bearing the body of the drowned man, and headed by that sorrowful matron, turned the corner of the house. Babalichai had taken the broken anklet off the man's leg, and now held it in his hand as he moved by the side of the bearers, while Mamat lingered behind timidly, in the hopes of the promised reward. "Lay him there," said Babalichai to Almayer's men, pointing to a pile of drying planks in front of the veranda. "Lay him there. He was a Kaffir and the son of a dog, and he was the white man's friend. He drank the white man's strong water," he added, with affected horror. "Had I have seen myself." The men stretched out the broken limbs on two planks they had laid level, while Mrs. Almayer covered the body with a piece of white cotton cloth, and after whispering for some time with Babalichai departed to her domestic duties. Almayer's men, after laying down their burden, dispersed themselves in quest of shady spots wherein to idle the day away. Babalichai was left alone by the corpse, that laid rigid under the white cloth in the bright sunshine. Nina came down the steps and joined Babalichai, who put his hand to his forehead, and squatted down with great deference. "You have a bangle there," said Nina, looking down on Babalachi's upturned face and into his solitary eye. "I have, Mem Puta," returned the polite statesman. Then turning towards Mamat, he beckoned him closer, calling out, "Come here." Mamat approached with some hesitation. He avoided looking at Nina, but fixed his eyes on Babalachi. "Now, listen," said Babalachi, sharply. "Hearing and the anklet you have seen, and you know they belong to Dane the traitor, and to no other. Dane returned last night in a canoe. He spoke with the Raja, and in the middle of the night left to cross over to the white man's house. There was a great flood, and this morning you found him in the river. By his feet I dragged him out," muttered Mamat under his breath. "Oon Babalachi, there will be a recompense," he exclaimed aloud. Babalichai held up the gold bangle before Mamat's eyes. "Had I have told you, Mamat, is for all ears. What I give you now is for your eyes only. Take." Mamat took the bangle eagerly and hid it in the folds of his waistcloth. "Am I a fool, to show this thing in a house with three women in it?" he growled. "But I shall tell them about Dane the traitor, and there will be talk enough." He turned and went away, increasing his pace, as soon as he was outside Almayer's compound. Babalichai looked after him till he disappeared behind the bushes. "Have I done well, Mem Puta?" he asked, humbly addressing Nina. "You have," answered Nina. "Hearing you may keep yourself." Babalichai touched his lips and forehead, and scrambled to his feet. He looked at Nina, as if expecting her to say something more, but Nina turned towards the house, and went up the steps, motioning him away with her hand. Babalichai picked up his staff and prepared to go. It was very warm, and he did not care for the long pull to the Raja's house. Yet he must go and tell the Raja tell of the event, of the change in his plans, of all his suspicions. He walked to the jetty, and began casting off the rattan painter of his canoe. The broad expanse of the lower reach, with its shimmering surface dotted by the black specks of the fishing canoes, lay before his eyes. The fishermen seemed to be racing. Babalichai paused in his work, and looked on with sudden interest. The man in the foremost canoe, now within hail of the first houses of Sambar, laid in his paddle and stood up shouting, "The boats, the boats! The man of war's boats are coming! They are here!" In a moment the settlement was again alive with people rushing to the riverside. The men began to unfasten their boats, the women stood in groups looking towards the bend down the river. Above the trees lining the reach a slight puff of smoke appeared like a black stain on the brilliant blue of the cloudless sky. Babalichai stood perplexed, the painter in his hand. He looked down the reach, then up towards Almayer's house, and back again at the river, as if undecided what to do. At last he made the canoe fast again hastily, and ran towards the house, and up the steps of the veranda. "Tuan! Tuan!" he called, eagerly. The boats are coming. The man of war's boats. You had better get ready. The officers will come here, I know. Almayer lifted his head slowly from the table and looked at him stupidly. Mem Puta, exclaimed Babalichai to Nina, look at him. He does not hear. You must take care, he added meaningly. Nina nodded to him with an uncertain smile, and was going to speak, when a sharp report from the gun mounted in the bow of the steam launch that was just then coming into view arrested the words on her parted lips. The smile died out, and was replaced by the old look of anxious attention. From the hills far away the echo came back like a long-drawn and mournful sigh, as if the land had sent it in answer to the voice of its masters. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.